individual candidates will be in order. Raymond Darwin Cameron III, Doctor of Philosophy and Zoophysiology. Dr. Cameron received his Bachelor of Science degree from Ursinus College, Pennsylvania, in 1963. Dwayne Russell Packer, Doctor of Philosophy in Geology, Geophysics. Dr. Packer received his Bachelor of Science degree from Colorado College in 1969. Arnold Lee Snyder, Jr., Doctor of Philosophy in Geophysics. Dr. Snyder received a Bachelor of Civil Engineering degree from George Washington University, Washington, D.C. in 1960, his Master of Science from the University of Colorado in 1966. Lieutenant Colonel Lucian Prokopowicz, Professor of Military Science, present the candidates for Army commissions.
Will the candidates for commissions in the United States Army Reserve please rise and come forward? President Wood, upon the recommendation of the faculty of the Department of Military Science and approved by the President of the United States, I present to you these candidates for commissions whose names are listed on the official program.
Thank you, Colonel. I have the honor of serving on behalf of the President of the United States in presenting each of you with your commission in the Army of the United States. You have been selected for this honor because special confidence is reposed in your patriotism, valor, fidelity, and ability. To have merited this confidence is for each of you an achievement. And I charge you so to live and so to act that you may ever prove worthy of this distinction.
Mark D. Anderson. Robert E. Hiller, Jr. G. Taylor Jones. Thomas W. Monk. Frederick S. Robards. Michael S. Rugani. Samuel R. Dwarek.
Thank you.
class of 1972. You are the historic 50th graduating class of the University of Alaska. You and your university are particularly honored today by the presence of Governor William A. Egan and former territorial governor Ernest Greening. Governor Egan and Dr. Greening, you are the only chief state officers who have, while in office, participated in our commencement ceremonies. And we're grateful to each of you and to Mrs. Egan and to Mrs. Greening for being here. I believe it was just 36 years ago that Ernest Greening gave the commencement address at this university. Now, statewide, the University of Alaska 1972 academic graduates number more than 800. And this is greater than the total of full-time students enrolled in the university just 12 years ago when first I came to the campus. That year, 1960, there were 101 graduates, 10 associates at Anchorage, 80 bachelors, 9 masters, and 2 professional degrees in Fairbanks. In 1948, when president of the Board of Regents, William O'Neill, was first appointed to the board, and it's nearly a quarter of a century ago, there were 28 graduates. And this year, including the 372 who received their diplomas in Anchorage last Friday, and the 434 of you at Fairbanks today, and the 15 to receive degrees next week in Juneau, Ketchikan, Matanuska, Susitna. In the class of 1972, there are 127 associates, 445 bachelors, 244 masters, and there were to be 5 PhDs. An eightfold growth in only a dozen years. Now, I've written myself a little note here. These numbers are preliminary, and the final count, I believe, is 773, just short of the 800. This great growth in the number of graduates is not merely the result of increased enrollment, nor of population, but the holding power of a vastly enhanced learning environment, greatly improved programs and teaching, and intensified interest in the special concerns of individual students. For all of this and more, we're indebted to the taxpayers of Alaska and to their elected officials and representatives. And for one, I am wholly convinced that you, the graduates of the university, are the finest thing that has ever happened in Alaska and fully justify every cent that has been spent on the university throughout the state. And if there is a wiser investment possible of private and public money, state and federal, I cannot imagine what it might be. Education, sound education for the many, is not cheap, especially in a time of excessive inflation. But there is no alternative, no safe retreat. Either educate the people or perish as a people. Yet all of us in education, students, faculty, staff, administration, regents, can work at our mission in better, more effective ways. And let us not confine our attention in this matter to education alone. Better and more effective ways are an urgent necessity in all aspects of our national life. As you leave the university, you will become increasingly aware over the next several months and years, if they are left to us, that no one yet has devised a way to distribute what has not first been produced. And further, the reckless assumption that one can continuously demand a greater return for a lower rate of production is obviously self-defeating. To produce more for the same or for less is to ensure the future of the nation and one's own. But to produce less for the same or for more in any line of endeavor is ultimately to destroy one's livelihood and security. Examples are well known and growing in number. The railroad situation is said to be a classic case, but only one of many, including primary industries and trades, government at all levels, yes, and even education. Nowadays, the dollar doesn't go as far as it once did for us. for we are not willing, apparently, to go as far for the dollar as we once did. Fundamentally, it's impossible for any of us to pay more to anyone for producing less. There is no way for any nation or any enterprise of that nation to sustain higher wages and increased human benefits without increasing productivity. And let's not overlook the obvious fact that this basic principle applies to higher education in all its functions: research, instruction, public service, and all supporting services, especially the administrative services. One of you asked me a few days ago if we couldn't close the productivity gap that's been developing between the United States and such countries as West Germany and Japan by consuming less. It's an appealing notion. Let's change our lifestyle and return to the simple past. Let's decrease our mobility. Let's walk, not ride. Let's talk with one another rather than listening to the output of modern electronic media. Let's live in shacks instead of ticky-tacky boxes. Let's burn wood or buffalo chips instead of oil or gas or electricity. And I wonder if our new lifestyle is not an attempt to escape from reality and responsibility. A turning back toward the cradle of time has not much appeal. To be realistic, the struggle for survival existence of the farm boy of a century ago, or even 50 years ago, is not all that attractive to any knowledgeable person. That way of life wasn't satisfying for all then, or some of us wouldn't be here today. It cannot now for very long contain human restlessness, the endless quest for a better way. Unhappily, the new lifestyle for the few depends upon the largesse and tolerance of an affluent society, a society whose affluence already is waning. No amount of political power or political maneuvering can give to even the best causes what has not first been produced by someone. And yet, as individuals, we sometimes try. For somehow we think there's a way to defy a fundamental law of economics and to get away with it. Always, of course, at the expense of others. If only one had power, political power, so the daydreaming goes, one could quickly get his heart's desire. Always, of course, from what others have, never from what one has created or built for oneself. This assumes that an abundance is at hand and that further production is both unnecessary and undesirable. Now, the daydreaming featuring a future based on political power, unsupported by increased productivity of society, would bring the fun and the excitement of change, to be sure. But let's not put all our chips on politics. Let us tackle as many as possible of our problems with the common sense, determination, and goodwill that lies within each of us as a self-reliant individual. Let us turn from status seeking, a trying always to be. Let us turn from striving for possessions and power, a trying always to have. Rather, let us put our hands and heads and heart to producing a trying always to do as much as one can for the common good as well as for oneself. As university graduates, I urge you to concentrate your intelligence, your competence, your enthusiasm upon doing, upon production. And I urge you to minimize the time spent merely upon trying to be somebody or to have power over something. And I know this sounds a bit old-fashioned, but do you know a better way to the good life? Does anyone? Now, I've been called a builder, sometimes in derision, by those who have never known the joy nor the humility of building or creating anything. And it takes years and years and years to build a good university. Class of 1972, you are graduating from a very good university, celebrating its 50th commencement. Justly proud of a notable, highly competent faculty and staff of excellence and distinction. Even now among them, marks of greatness are emerging, better known perhaps and more closely observed outside of Alaska than within. And it's time these were recognized and encouraged here, or we may lose them. I'm proud to salute the talented faculty statewide who are building a great University of Alaska in name and in fact. Many of the faculty and staff have been attracted to Alaska during the past dozen years and several a few years earlier. Altogether, they are of genuine quality. Their amazing patience, good sense, great strength, and splendid sense of humor will see all of us through a somewhat difficult time when universities everywhere are being challenged by the public. And Governor, I am wholly confident that the superior faculty and staff of this university and their fine students will provide a campus response to the public challenge that you and all Alaskans will find worthy of your highest confidence and respect. Already the assembly, a cross-section of the university family, is at work on a major planning study seeking more effective ways of packaging courses, programs, ideas, concepts, skills, attitudes, and relationships that form the content of instruction. They're examining all manner of delivery systems to revitalize and upgrade the quality of the teaching process, lecture demonstration, large groups, small groups, educational television and radio, independent study, tutorials, skill training stations. And similar studies will be underway in research, public service, supporting services, and always with close attention to cost effectiveness. But we shall not sacrifice the quality in so doing. Some restructuring of programs at administration in all aspects of the university is in prospect. It will be done in an intelligent, thoughtful manner, in the best interests of Alaska, from within the university, under the policy guidance of a dedicated, far-seeing, hard-working Board of Regents. And as for my part, I shall be cheering from the sidelines, for I have requested permission of the board to retire from the presidency by 1 July 1973. The time has come to take myself out of the game. The Illinois College class of 1927, of which I am pleased and proud to be a member, will hold its 45th reunion just 2 weeks from today. 1927 to 1972. The numbers are the same, but they are arranged a bit differently. In 44 of those years between, I've been a teacher, a coach, an administrator, as well as a textbook editor and an educational consultant. There have been some games lost and some games won. And looking back, I have only one real regret. Time ran out too fast. Class of 1972, at your 45th reunion in the year 2017, may you recall your own careers with a quiet sense of fulfillment. From the good start you have made, I know the commendation from all who know you will be well done, as it is from all of us here today who know you. Class number 50. Long ago, Byron put it best. Fare thee well. And if forever, still forever fare thee well.
Representing the class of 72 will give a response.
Although I've been asked to speak on behalf of the vintage graduating class of 1972, I find that's nearly an impossible thing to do. What could anyone say that represented the views of an entire class? For a class is made up of as many individuals, each facing an infinite variety of situations and looking to find an infinite variety of different things. At this university, more than at others, the road to graduation is a very individual trip. There is not a cohesive unit that goes through 4 years together, experience the same things, and facing the same problems. There are many transfer students here, and many who took off several years between their first and their last year. All of us have very different reasons for wanting that diploma. It is no longer an exclusive pass to the high-paying, prestigious jobs, although for some that is the reason for getting a diploma. My mother once told me that any woman with a college education could tell any man to go to hell, and I'm sure for some that is a reason for getting a diploma. But the fact is, we are not one single unit, a class uniquely distinct from other classes, beyond the fact that we're all unique individuals. So to say that I speak for the class of 1972 would be a mistake. I speak of what I, as one member of this loosely defined class, have seen at this university, and what I see as a possible direction for us to take away from this university. The university is a very temporary environment, and any activity within that sphere is by nature limited and temporary also. There is only so much students can do because there's only so much that students can understand. The biggest problem, however, is that a student movement only has a limited audience. We can only talk to other students, for only other students know what we're talking about or care what we're concerned about. There is no group that is more powerless than students, because for a time they are not a part of the larger society and they do not have access to the real power sources. Student movements tend to be artificial because the environment in which they are created is also artificial. And the problems students encounter pale besides the problems of the public at large and the world outside the university. In fact, most of the public could care less what the students are doing or what they're thinking. Who would really care if every student went on strike to protest the situation we find on our campuses? Student movements are built of ideas and philosophy and historical proof. But the movement of society in general is based on the job, the rent, and the price of food. And these are the things that we must now concern ourselves with. The one inevitable fact which dooms any student movement and which the administration knows and relies upon is that eventually all student activists will graduate and leave the university. All they have to do is wait. And no matter how willing a student is to confront the reigning authority, which in this case is the university administration, this does not automatically carry over to the larger society outside, but it should. There's a war going on out there. People are dying and people are starving. Men have been festering in prisoner of war camps going on 10 years. For some of us, that's the time since we've been in junior high school. Most of the world is concerned merely with survival. and we concern ourselves with drinking in the dorms, or even such worthwhile causes as student representation on the Board of Regents. As students, we are bound to face the problems of the campus. But beyond the campus, the problems are larger, more complex, and far more serious. And the problems outside of our academic sphere will not be solved by logic, reasoning, and philosophic truth. It is up to students to change the environment they find themselves in, and it is up to non-students to change the rest. If we allow society to concern itself only with what the students on our campuses are doing, there is no hope for any meaningful change in the society as a whole. As long as we let students carry the burden of the anti-war issue or the other vital questions that we face, the movement is doomed, for a student's outlook is narrow and his concerns are limited. Don't look back with nostalgia on these university days as the final fling at freedom and action, for students have no monopoly on activism, and by its very nature, student activism is not the kind that will ultimately make any differences. The university is a training ground for many things. Mostly, however, it is a session in developing powers of observation, in developing a critical outlook, and a resistance to the devices that those in power use to lull the people into passivity. For the forces that move the university leaders are the same that move national leaders. I've spent the better part of the last 2 years trying to point the finger at hypocrisy, mismanagement, and unconcern as I saw it. The almost daily interactions I had with those who run this university and the information I had access to through the student newspaper taught me much about those forces. It gave me an insight to the motives and mannerisms of those who assume control of other people. I'm sure many people got tired of listening to my one-track pursuit of the administration. In fact, I can think of about a half a dozen journalism majors which the school will be quite happy to get rid of. But the university cannot graduate its problems away by getting rid of those who choose to talk about them. Let's not fool ourselves into thinking that the problems here are the ones that will be important when we graduate and leave the university. The graduating student activist would do well to divorce himself from the student movement and student tactics, for that is not where the solution lies to the rest. This is not to discount the student role in the anti-war or civil rights movements, but even war and racism are not the real problems. They are but products of a system, a giant, complex, ingenious, inhuman system that has taken the ideals of this nation and twisted them beyond recognition. So where do we go from here? In the end, it comes down to each individual coming to terms with the environment and the society in which he finds himself, and having the individual strength to face up to it. It is a frightening thing to have to take responsibility for the state of the world, or even for our own actions. But if we deny that responsibility, we are denying our individual worth. In saying that one person can do nothing, we are striking at the very principle upon which this country was founded, and that is that every man is unique and does have worth. It is important for the individual to act, to do something about what he sees around him, no matter how small the problem may seem. For if we ignore the small ones, who can expect us to take on the larger ones? Do not depend on the people to rise up and act for you. The great movements of the people are a myth. What good is there in fighting for the rights of the people? Have the people ever fought for you? Don't cry for the poor people of Vietnam whose lives are so cheap in the face of big government. Cry for yourself, for it is your own dignity and worth that is assailed with the loss of every human life in that war. Don't act for the people, act for yourself. The activities we engage in while at a university should be for your own betterment. The battles we fight should be very personal ones, for it is not the rights of the students that get violated every day, it is your rights as an individual. It only takes one person to effect changes, one person with his eyes open and a mouth big enough to tell the truth as he sees it. It was your individual initiative that got you that diploma you're holding in your hand right now. No people earn that for you, so don't waste it on them. Use it for yourself. And do not trust those who say that they are only working for the good of the people. So many of this university's shortcomings are due to the public insistence of its officials that they really care about the people, in this case, the students. They feel compelled to form committees, agencies, and activities for the students, but their actions have shown time and again that it is not the students they are interested in at all. The university is a well-organized company, and the only purpose of its junior and senior executives is to keep the boss happy. If there are complaints from the consumers for an improved product, they may make minor concessions, but only to keep the rabble quiet. So why do they keep up the pretense of working for the students? It would certainly be easier to cope with them if their intentions were out in the open. But instead, it is shrouded in the appearances of businesslike activity. Excellence in the classroom and all that it implies may be the stated purpose for their jobs. But judging from the way those jobs are performed, education in the classroom must have a very low priority indeed. To cut costs, they suggest cutting class offerings by one-third, for supposedly administrative cuts would have a negligible effect on the budget. Even the student union building is not that at all. It is a business investment with a money-making potential. Students are important to that building only in the amount of money they can spend there. So let's not kid ourselves. They didn't really care much about us when we were passing through this university. And the powers that be outside of this university don't care much either. So we've got to care about ourselves. And we've got to take on the responsibility of fighting our own battles, for no one will take them for us. The administrators of this university are pursuing their own interests, so why shouldn't we?